Hello, I'm Will Starrett. This is number 0625, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0625. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, with his recent railing against his network, we thought we'd feature a conversation from 2000 with Seth MacFarlane, the creator and major voice talent behind Family Guy on Fox. My favorite character is Baby Stewie, and that voice came to Seth from an impersonation he did of actor Rex Harrison.
It really emerged out of this impression that I used to do in college. Where the idea came to put it in the body of this baby, I couldn't tell you. You know, I come from an animation background, so bizarre stuff like that is sort of kind of regular run-of-the-mill stuff as far as I'm concerned. The personality of the overly melodramatic 19th century villain, there's something that's always kind of amused about that whole persona of just the villain who's so confident that it's just laughable, and the idea of putting it in this baby's mouth is, you know, I couldn't tell you. I think I was drunk that evening.
Hillary MacLeod is a broadcaster, professor, and mystery writer with 6 novels under her belt. All of her mysteries take place in a small PEI village, which is where she summers.
I know, it's so much fun to do that. And this village is right outside my, I'm looking out my window at it now, because you would find not very much difference between my description of the village in these books and the real life outside here. You know, I love the place, I love the people, I love the quirkiness of some of the characters who live here. I borrowed from them, stolen perhaps.
Stuart Nullman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman. Book Banter examines a hidden chapter of World War II with Malcolm Gladwell's The Bomber Mafia. So off we go into the wild blue yonder later on the Stuff File program.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0625, was Will Starrett, who is the breakfast presenter at KMBZ in Kansas City. That means he's the morning show personality, not that he's serving the morning crew their first meal of the day. Thank you very much, Will, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? In London, Ontario, a persnickety homeowner took matters into his own hands on July 30th when he ran his car into a neighbor who had been urinating on his lawn. The 38-year-old driver struck the victim, throwing him several meters and causing a gash on the back of his head. The driver was charged with dangerous operation of a vehicle causing bodily harm, which could get him 10 years in prison. So, basically, everything the driver did was counterproductive. I mean, if you're trying to stop a neighbor from urinating on your lawn, hitting him with your car doesn't solve the problem. In fact, I'm pretty sure hitting someone with your car is going to release all of their bodily fluids. And speaking of being hit, the bells mean it's time for the Darwin File.
I am the Grim Reaper. I am death.
Two North Carolina brothers were killed by a train at the site where another brother had also been struck and killed a week earlier. Charlotte Mecklenburg police officers responded to a report of two pedestrians struck by a Lynx Blue Line light rail train. Officers found 29-year-old Pablo Tikrawam Us and his 20-year-old brother Jose unresponsive near the tracks. Medics pronounced both men dead at the scene. The two had been walking north on the southbound tracks just after 5 a.m. to conduct a memorial for their brother, 27-year-old Baltazar, who died July 26th when he drove across the tracks into the path of an oncoming train. Authorities stressed that the safety mechanisms for the train line were working properly. The conductor stopped the train after the brothers were hit. Investigators suspect alcohol impairment was a contributing factor to the incident. Let's just hope that if there are any more members of this family left, that they keep a train schedule in their back pocket. Because the tree of life is often self-pruning.
I have come for you.
The drive-through window clerk at a Burger King in Livonia, Michigan, got into an argument with three customers. The clerk allegedly ended the argument by pulling a gun, pointing it at the customers as he leaned out of the window. No surprise, the customers sped off and called police. The clerk ran, but police quickly caught up with and arrested 24-year-old Dustin Rochelieu on 8 felony counts, and a gun was found in his backpack.
Hold the pickle, hold the lettuce, special orders don't upset us.
So now we know, special orders do upset them.
Any way you think is proper, have it your way.
Nope. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, Mark Parhar is on trial for 3 counts of violating Canada's Quarantine Act after attending a meeting in the U.S. and then allegedly refusing to isolate himself when he returned to B.C. He was jailed for 4 days. Parhar, a vocal COVID denier, called it an illegal, unlawful criminal trial. He has a history of legal troubles during the pandemic, like when the city of Delta, BC revoked his hot yoga studios license after he encouraged patrons to come, claiming the heat would kill coronavirus. Of course, fake COVID plots aren't the only conspiracy theories that Parhar subscribes to. The meeting he went to in the U.S. to attend? The Flat Earth International Conference. Wow. He brings new meaning to living on the edge, doesn't he? You know, I went to his Facebook page. This is an anti-vaxxer, flat earth believer who skydives and has at least 1 young child. He also claims to have gone to university. And when I read his Facebook page, I'm beginning to wonder how he has a Facebook page. And with almost 5,000 friends, which is the maximum. Our very round world is in trouble, folks. I mean, looking at his Facebook postings, each one is more jaw-dropping and mind-numbing than the previous one. I didn't consider making him the idiot of the day because being an idiot is something that usually requires a singular, solitary moment in time where an action stands on its own. But this guy, wow, it's ongoing. It just makes you want to scream.
Stupid! You're so stupid!
Go ahead, say it again. It needs to be repeated.
Stupid! You're so stupid!
You know, when the aliens come, this is the first guy getting an anal probe. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our first segment here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Earlier this month, Seth MacFarlane, the creator of the long-running animated series Family Guy, came out against the parent company of his network, Fox Entertainment, because of the antics of their corporate sibling, Fox News. In a tweet, Seth said, "Tucker Carlson's latest opinion piece once again makes me wish Family Guy was on any other network. Look, Fox, we both know this marriage isn't working anymore. The sex is only once a year. I don't get along with your mother. And, well, I've been having an affair with NBC. That last line is in reference to the mega TV deal Seth made last year with NBC Universal. Anyway, it's hard to believe that Family Guy has already been on the air for 2 decades and has already been renewed through season 21 by Fox. It seems like just yesterday that I had the first of 4 conversations that I had with the multi-talented animation creator. I thought we'd go back down memory lane to part of a conversation we had back when the show was in its infancy. It takes us back to May of 2000.
It is certainly one of the most innovative shows that has come along, and every time I watch it, I keep thinking to myself, Does this guy just sit down and think, what can I get past the censors this week?
You know, it's interesting. We there's about 20 of us, about 20 writers, and excuse me, I mean, including myself. We've never set out to really shock or deliberately offend. What we put in is what we think is funny. You know, sometimes that happens to be a little on the edge, and that's when we have our battles with the censors. But you know, I think on the whole, it's definitely edgier than The Simpsons. I would think we sort of push the envelope a little bit more. But you know, we don't set out to shock for shock's sake.
I think I read something when the show first went on the air that you had a very interesting pitch meeting when you did all the first of all, you do three characters in the show yourself.
Right, right.
You do Stewie, which, by the way, is my favorite. Stewie is amazing. You do Stewie, you do Peter, and you do Brian.
Brian the dog, yep.
And what was that pitch meeting like when you went in there to do that?
You know, it really, I think that may have had something to do with them picking up the show, but I'm not sure. They responded very enthusiastically. I showed them, you know, sketches of the characters that I had done and sort of gave them, you know, sound bites and little things like, you know, typical lines of dialogue that might come out of these characters' mouths, and sort of tried to give them a sense of the whole personalities of each of these characters, and in that way, you know, it was in a lot of ways maybe a little easier than pitching a live action sitcom, because you can really give them a sense of who these people are right there in the room.
A lot has been made since the show came on the air of, as they say, your tender age. I mean, was that a help or a hindrance growing in? Because, you know, a lot of times people look at somebody who's young and they go, oh, here's this kid with this idea. Let's pat him on the head and give him some time.
You know, I think in this particular day and age, I think it's almost a, and this is unfortunate, I think, actually, but I think it's almost a help. There seems to be this trend towards hiring younger producers and you know, younger creators. You know, I'm certainly happy that that's the case. I think it's a good thing and a bad thing, you know, for obvious reasons. But, you know, I was never really treated as, that damn kid with the runny nose. I was never really condescended to by anybody. They really, you know, they saw the pilot. They knew that, they could see I knew what I was doing as far as the animation medium was concerned. And, they were very you know, as far as Fox, I went through the network. As far as Fox development was concerned, they were really supportive all the way.
I mentioned earlier that, sometimes your show can be hard to find. When you first went on the air, you were lucky enough to go up in the prime post-Super Bowl spot.
Yeah.
And had great ratings. And then they moved you, if I'm not mistaken, to after The Simpsons. Is that correct?
Yeah, they moved us to Sundays and kept us there for about six episodes. And moved us again to Thursdays after that, which was a little bit of a rocky period for us, because it was, the move came too soon. We really didn't get a chance to build our audience on Sundays the way we would have liked.
And they had you up against Frasier, right?
Yeah, and surprisingly enough, it should be noted that the show has really, you know, through all its moves, has managed to maintain its fan following. I mean, we've really, fans who've just been rabid about keeping up with this show no matter where it is, which has really been great for us.
When it comes to animation, you don't find a lot of people like yourself who are producers of animation who, not since Walter Lantz, I guess, who people who produce cartoons and do the voices themselves. Is that not too much of a stretch for you?
Did Walter Lantz do Woody Woodpecker?
For a few years he did, yeah.
Did he really?
Yeah.
Must have been those really early,
yeah.
Yeah,
yeah.
Where he was all creepy.
Yeah.
No, his wife took over after that.
That's right. His wife took over after that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. My God. Yeah, you know, I think, Mike Judge obviously is well known for doing that. He does, obviously Beavis and Butthead and Hank Hill and King of the Hill. You know, I think it depends on the person. I mean, that's the voice of a character has always been, you know, as basic a part of creating this character as the visual design. So I usually the voice comes first with me, and I'll do the design after the fact. But it just depends on the particular producer.
Where did the voice of Stewie come from?
Voice of Stewie it's basically an impression of Rex Harrison. who's one of my all-time favorite actors, and every once in a while you see a little bit of Henry Higgins popping up in that here. He did a rendition of I've Grown Accustomed to Her Face, which is obviously from from My Fair Lady in one of our episodes. So that it really emerged out of this impression that I used to do in college. Where the idea came to put it in the body of this baby, I couldn't tell you. You know, I come from an animation background, so bizarre stuff like that is sort of kind of regular run-of-the-mill stuff as far as that's concerned.
Where did the idea come to make Dewey just positively evil? I love the kid. He's great.
You know, it's the personality of the overly melodramatic 19th century villain. There's something that's always kind of a... always kind of amused me about that whole persona of just the villain who's so confident that it's just laughable, and the idea of putting it in this baby's mouth is I couldn't tell you. I think I was drunk that evening.
Now some people are confused when they watch a show because they're wondering, okay, which wall has been broken down here? Does the family hear the dog? Does the family hear Stewie?
Yeah, this is a question we're asked a lot. We Brian can be understood by everybody. Brian, right, being the dog, okay, the family can understand him. You know, the neighbors can, the whole population of this world can understand him, and he's just treated maybe with a little less respect than a human would be. But he's they can hear him and understand him. Stewie is where most of the confusion lies. He people can hear him. They can hear that he speaks. They just don't attach any more significance to anything that he says than you would to something that comes out of a three-year-old's mouth. You know, if a three-year-old tells you to go to hell, you know, you figure you laugh because you must have heard that on TV or whatever. You know, it's just there's some amusement to it, and that's the way they treat Stewie, and that sort of aggravates him even further. But we actually did a gag. We did an episode where Peter starts his own nation in his own backyard and sort of secedes from the United States. And at the end of the episode, you cut to 200 years later, and a class of futuristic students is learning about this whole escapade of his. And one of the kids in the back raises his hand and said, "Yeah, I have a question. Can the family understand the baby, or what's that all about?" So it's a question that keeps cropping up.
With the show being on the schedule and off the schedule and on the schedule, that's a problem that a lot of producers of a lot of television shows have. But I'm going on the assumption that it's even more difficult when you're doing an animated show, because you guys need a lot more lead time than a live-action show does. Correct?
Yeah, it takes about 33 weeks to do each episode. Yeah, it has been a problem for us, because we haven't, in a lot of ways, the show has been really kind of mishandled. Again, I'm amazed that we've managed to keep our fan following amidst all that. And it makes it very difficult, and it is something that we're kind of tangling with right now. Only the future will tell how that resolves itself.
33 weeks for an episode.
Yeah.
So at any given moment, how many episodes would you have in development at one time?
Probably, there's probably about maybe six in at any given time in various stages of production, something like that.
And how many have been produced so far, as opposed to how many have been aired?
Oh boy. I think we've aired about, let's see, there were seven first season, then the New Year's episode, that's eight, and two more last year, that's 9, 10. This is fun, I'm sure, listening to me do math.
That's
on the
okay.
Air. Probably, I think about 16 episodes or 17 episodes, and we've done about 35 altogether.
So by the time they air,
yeah,
are they just as fresh to you as they are to the audience?
Absolutely not. We are so sick to death of them by the time they get on the air that, every one of these shows, I've seen about 50 times, and that's the one downside is that... some of the excitement of seeing it on the air is always kind of muted by the fact that I've seen each episode a billion times in various stages before then. So it's, it's part of the job, obviously.
And when you're sitting down writing these things with the gang, do you sit down and, as I said earlier, do you concern yourself with standards and practices, or do you just write the show because you think it's funny and
yeah,
see where it goes?
Yeah, if we're really absolutely certain that standards will not go for a certain joke, then we won't waste our time with it. But usually if it's something that we think is funny and we think it's winnable, we'll put it in and worry about the fight later. And that's standards has been. They haven't been too strict with us. I mean, they rein us in, when they feel really strongly about something. But they've really, they do tend to look at things like whether the gag is funny. It's very arbitrary.
Several years ago, I had the opportunity to talk to one of the producers of The Simpsons, and he was telling me the fact that there were things that they couldn't do on The Simpsons or things that they could do on The Simpsons that could never happen in a live-action show. And one of the things I found rather interesting is they were telling me that they could not do any harm to the Simpsons' dog.
Huh.
But they could do whatever they want to do with Itchy and Scratchy. Because that was a cartoon in a cartoon.
You know, it's interesting how it all depends on how Standards chooses to look at a character. I mean, Stewie is a constant source of argument with Standards, because he's really, in a lot of ways, they look at him as a baby and they treat him as a baby, and we're constantly saying, well, you know, you can't really apply the same rules because he's not really, you know, what category does he fall into? You can't say, well, he's an infant, therefore he can't use bad language. But, you know, at the same time, he's this bitter, you know, stifled character who's, you know, who's dying to break out of his tiny body and rule the world. So it's, you know, it's you know, every situation is different.
He can't say anything bad, as you say, but I don't think I've ever laughed as hard as, I think, what the first or second episode, when he was referring to escaping from the Ovarian Bastille?
Yeah, oh yeah, that was the, that was the pilot.
I when I heard that, I thought, okay, I've seen something definitely new on television, new and fresh.
Yeah, he's a character who's you know, there are many directions that Stewie has yet to that we have yet to explore with him. We're hoping that Fox will you know, give us that chance.
I'm almost afraid to see him in a playgroup.
Yeah, well, yeah, there's, you know, we have an episode coming up where he does go into daycare. And that's all I'll tell you about that. I don't want to spoil it.
Okay. Out of the three characters that you do, which one do you have the most fun with yourself?
It's interesting. There's several. I gotta say, probably Quagmire. Quagmire being one of the newer characters, who's the next door neighbor, and you know, fans of the show by now will, you know, certainly know who he is. He's just sort of this sex hound who's you know, his house is decorated in a very 50s lounge style fashion. He's just his values are completely outdated. He's just, you know, the most sexist guy alive. It's just this disgusting yet lovable character who's you know, new to this season, and he's I would say the most fun.
Have you reached a point now where the show has become successful enough that what has happened with some other series, like The Simpsons, you get guest stars who want to be part of the show? I mean, recently I saw the episode, I guess, which had the cast from Murphy Brown.
Yeah.
And they were actually poking fun at themselves, and I thought, oh, well, these have to be sound-alikes. I'm waiting for the end of the credits now, and I'm thinking, well, that was really them.
Yeah. You know, it just depends. You know, you have some people who are really good sports and you know, have the ability to laugh at themselves, and, you know, others who maybe don't. And, you know, it really varies. I mean, usually it's tough to get people to... When you're talking about people playing themselves or something like that, it's kind of tougher than to get a guest star on to play another, you know, a different character. One of the things, one episode has aired with this character, but Adam West of Batman fame, obviously, has joined the cast as himself. But it's sort of this, you know, he's the mayor of Quahog, Mayor Adam West. He's, you know, we sort of play him up as this, you know, very paranoid, Howard Hughes type politician who's you know, just holed up in his office and you know, just, you know, terrified of the outside world because he thinks people are out to get him. He's been somebody who is you know, is very willing to poke fun at himself and really, you know, fabulous sense of comic timing and just a great actor.
Have you reached a point now where people are coming to you and saying, "Gee, is there a part for me on this show?"
Now and then, you know, there are certain people who are animation fans. You know, you know, Firuza Balk came a while back, you know, called and expressed an interest in being on the show, and she's done a couple episodes for us. It just depends on the actor. It's we're at the point where we are still in our second season, so you know, we still usually have to make the effort ourselves. Like we haven't yet reached the point that The Simpsons is at, obviously, in its 10th season, where people will call and ask to be on the show on a regular basis. But, it's getting easier and easier as we go along.
Are you hoping to reach a point when you have as many episodes as The Simpsons does? Would you like to be doing this 10 years from now?
I think 10 seasons is too much, actually. I think that it's amazing that show has managed to stay, you know, stay as fresh as it has for that long. To me, I can't imagine going longer than maybe seven. You know, we'll be fortunate to get there.
Obviously, since you've got so many shows in development, before we get a chance to see them, there is a lot for us to learn as fans of the Griffin family. But what about for yourself? Are there still things you're learning about the characters as you go along with them?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I mean, you know, when you, and a lot of you know, new elements of these characters are added or contributed by, you know, writers who you know, the respective writers who will write drafts of these particular scripts. I mean, every once in a while somebody will come up with like a new quirk or a new habit of Peter's or Brian's or whoever, and they will put it in a script, and it'll score really well at our table readings, and you know, we'll revisit that element. You know, it depends on the character. Lois has evolved a lot since the beginning, and I think a lot of that had to do with Alex Borstein, who's the actress who does that character, and she was actually a writer on our show for a while, and really, you know, took that character in a direction that, you know, I think only she could. So it was, you know, that was very surprising. Yeah, I think I'm constantly learning new things about these characters on a regular basis.
I can't let you go before hearing from Stewie. Is there anything that Stewie would like to say to the audience in Montreal?
The audience in Montreal, I say, you just stay within your own bloody borders. You understand that? Because we've got a lot of big guns down here.
Oh, God. That's a faux pas, isn't it? I'm not supposed to talk like that to the Canadians.
Oh, sure. We hear it all the time. We hear
people, your people always have it. Yeah, you got a good sense of humor, right?
Absolutely.
One of my best friends is a Canadian. All right.
Well, there are a lot of us.
Kind of milking it here.
Seth, I thank you very, very much for talking with us. Again, the show is The Family Guy. It's seen on Fox. Thank you for talking to us.
Oh, no problem.
That was a conversation from May 2000 with Seth MacFarlane, creator of the long-running animation series Family Guy. It's currently on Fox and will probably continue to be on Fox for the foreseeable future, but there is certainly a strained relationship there. By the way, Patreon subscribers to the Stuff File program, you can hear three more chats with Seth as Patreon reward extras. There's two conversations from 2003 and one from 2004, where Seth and I discuss, among other things, the short-lived cancellation of the show, the success of its DVD collection, which helped to bring it back, and the live cast readings that he was preparing to do here in Montreal for Just for Laughs. Go to our Patreon page, and if you're not already a member, become one of the select patrons of the show. Visit patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a show that's heard on many fine radio stations, such as CKLU-FM in Sudbury.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. Here's a penny for your thoughts from the Stuff File program coming to you from Montreal, Canada, a country that doesn't have pennies.
And still to come on the program, we'll have a chat with mystery writer and professor and broadcaster Hilary MacLeod. Plus, Stuart Nullman is in with another edition of Book Banter, here on a show that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right back to the stuff. 65-year-old Charles Mullins was arrested on August the 3rd and charged with arson after a fire at his home in Boone County, Kentucky. According to police, firefighters were called to Mullins' home at around 3:15 a.m. Mullins admitted that he started the fire by turning on the gas stove, pouring gasoline around the house, and then lighting a piece of paper. Mullins said God told him to start the fire and leave Kentucky, which he probably won't be doing for some time now. He was held on $25,000 bond. You know, as someone who is religious, I'm well aware of the axiom that when you talk to God, that's having true faith. When God talks to you, that's a psychotic break. Sarah Weaver and her husband found their dream farmhouse in Skipack, Pennsylvania, and bought it in December in a bit of a rush. They decided to forego an inspection, but they did note that the seller's disclosure mentioned bees in wall. It wasn't until the weather warmed, however, that the Weavers became aware of the extent of the bees. When Alan Latanzi, a beekeeper in the area, came to remove them in late July, he eventually ended up with 450,000 bees, comprising three colonies. The Weavers paid $12,000 for the removal, which involved taking slate tiles off the outside wall one by one. Latasny estimates the bees had been there for 35 years. He had been called to the residence once before, but the owner at the time didn't want to pay for the removal. Hey, bees! Buzz off! Thank you. When the Weavers took ownership, the house was so dirty, Weaver said, and now that I'm thinking about it, I originally thought it was dirt on the windows that I cleaned, but it was probably honey because there were drip marks. Bet they're not using honey anytime soon. I know the Weavers had to pay $12,000 for the removal, but technically speaking, the bees were theirs. I mean, they were in the house. Shouldn't they get some money from whoever the bees are going? I mean, someone's going to be making money off of almost 500,000 bees. Shouldn't the Weavers get a cut? Just saying. In Pennsylvania, a man is facing charges after he barricaded himself in a treehouse after assaulting an elderly man and setting fire to a home. 20-year-old Joseph Alton Hawk was charged with arson and assault-related charges in North Buffalo Township. Pennsylvania State Police responded to a call shortly before 1 p.m. where it was reported that Hawk assaulted an 82-year-old man. While police were responding, it was also learned that Hawk allegedly set fire to the home and ran off. Multiple police agencies, including state police, local departments, canine officers, and helicopters, searched the area but could not find him. Police again responded to the home the next morning at 7:10 a.m. after reports that Hawk was seen there. When they arrived, they found Hawk barricaded by himself in a treehouse. He eventually surrendered without incident and was arrested. What I want to know is, how exactly do you barricade yourself in a treehouse? That should be the shortest standoff in the world. I mean, there's a certain sound that should have ended this rather quickly. No, 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 not the bees. Yeah, that would do it. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, police responding to a 1 a.m. domestic disturbance found a Florida couple covered in spaghetti following a physical confrontation that resulted in the pair's arrest on domestic battery charges. 45-year-old Stephanie Lannis and her boyfriend, 35-year-old Adolfo Rivera, were eating dinner in their Clearwater home when a verbal argument turned violent. During the physical confrontation, Lannis and Rivera each shoved a plate of spaghetti in the other's face. When the cops arrived at the residence, the duo was still covered in spaghetti.
Mamma mia, that's a spicy meatball!
The mutual combat, for which alcohol was a factor, led to Lannis and Rivera each being arrested for domestic battery. They were booked into the county jail and released the following day on their own recognizance. Gee. So what's for dinner the second night? This is not the first time that Lannis has run into trouble with the law. She was arrested for stabbing Rivera in the arm with a knife during a drunken fight on October 15th of last year. So, basically, if you're in that household, if you can't stand the heat, or the pasta, or the utensils, stay out of the kitchen. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? We last spoke to broadcaster and professor Hillary McLeod a decade ago when she just released her first mystery novel, Revenge of the Lobster Lover. Well, since then, she has released 6 novels in total, with the most recent one being Cod Only Knows. She joins us on the line from Prince Edward Island. Hi, Hillary.
Hi there, Peter.
Nice to have you back on the program with us. Now, the last time I spoke to you, as I said, it was just after your first one was released, and you had just won a Bookie Award. And at the time, I asked you if winning that award had boosted your writing confidence, and you said no. Well, now you have 6 novels out, so surely that helps.
Yes. Yes, not that I was ever particularly unconfident, but yes, no, it's satisfying to have done that many.
With the 6 novels out, would it be fair to say that you have definitely found your voice as a writer?
I don't really even know what that means. A lot of the time I hear that. I have found my voice in the mystery genre, I would say. But as a writer as a whole, no, I don't think so. That's my voice there, and I have other potential voices.
Now, at the time I spoke to you, I believe you had already started or finished writing the 2nd, and you were already thinking about the 3rd at the time we last chatted. So, are you someone who, even as you're writing, are always thinking about what's coming up next beyond the story you're writing now?
Yes, but not exactly in those terms. I'm not thinking, what's next, what's next? It's that it comes to you, that you're telling this story and maybe a scene or a character or something comes and you realize they don't belong in this story at this time. That'll be for the next one. And I've always known what the next one quite often will be titled and what it will be about. So it's just in a storage area.
Well, speaking of titles, you have Revenge of the Lobster Lover, Mind Over Muscles, All is Clam, Something Fishy, Bodies and Soul, S-O-L-E, and Cod Only Knows. I sense a theme here.
Yes, some people think they're cookbooks. they talk about my titles being edible. And, oh my, I never thought of it, that the mussels were edible, that the cod was edible.
So when you create these stories, and most of them take place in the Maritimes.
They all do.
Yeah, I get the feeling that it's sort of like a Murder, She Wrote kind of situation where all of these crimes take place in little sleepy villages.
I know, it's so much fun to do that. Just, and this village is right outside I'm looking out my window at it now, because you would find not very much difference between my description of the village in these books and the real life outside here.
Would you say your writing is a love letter to the region that you summer in?
Oh, yes. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, I love the place. I love the people. I love the quirkiness of some of the characters who live here. I borrowed from them, stolen, perhaps.
And what is the reaction of the people who live in the area to your books?
Well, they show up at the hall once every so many years and buy a ton of copies of my book and, you know, seem to be happy enough.
The other thing you also mentioned when we last talked to you is you were working on what you called a big, fat historical book based on PEI. Have you been working on that, or...?
Well, you know, you read it. That doesn't really quite work. I've got 65,000 words, which is a lot of words.
Right.
Compared to a mystery. A mystery is maybe 80, 85,000, 90,000. So you'd think, and so this other one at 65,000 words, the story is not nearly told. It's just kind of set up. But, you know, yeah, no. It hasn't been, you know, seriously gone over. I did read over it this COVID past winter. And thought about it a bit, but that's it at the moment.
Well, speaking of COVID, how did you pass the time? Because I've often asked this of writers. You know, writing is a very solitary way of life, and COVID gave that opportunity, forced that opportunity on people. Some people I've spoken to have done a lot of writing during the period of time and have been very creative. Some have not. Where do you fall in this category?
Not.
Okay.
I think I never had trouble before, you know, finding the time to do the writing, whatever time was allotted, whether I was working, you know, full time or retired or whatever. I always had time and the ability to write. I found it very difficult.
Now,
in the COVID year and a bit.
Now, if I'm not mistaken, when I spoke to you, you were still working as a professor. Have you now retired?
Oh, yes, I have. I retired 10 years ago now.
Oh, so
almost, I think maybe you pushed me into retirement.
I was about to say, was it something I said?
Yeah. Yeah, and that was, I had already started the books, but that was my segue from working life to retired author, was that period of time bridging the last year or two of my work as a professor and the beginning of the novels.
As I mentioned, the last one you did was Cod Only Knows, and that was a couple of years ago. Are you working on any other mysteries coming up?
I do have one called A Flock of Seagulls. And I have about 45,000 words. But, again, it's sitting there at the moment, I'm sorry to say.
What is the reaction? I mean, you say that the locals have purchased your books, so they seem to like them, obviously. What is the reaction beyond the shores of Prince Edward Island? How well do your books do in the rest of the country or even beyond?
Oh, yeah. I had an Australian woman called Hillary MacLeod email me. And she loved the fact that she shared my name and had enjoyed the book. So although there's no specific marketing target for that far away, but they get around somehow. They travel. I've had friends who've left them on cruise ships, you know, as a kind of weird sort of marketing, I guess.
Well, actually, that's interesting. I mean, the cruising industry hasn't been what it has been thanks to COVID in the last little while. But when that starts up again, have you ever thought of doing one of those readings on a cruise ship? Because I know authors who have gotten some great business out of that captive audience that's on a cruise ship. Plus, yeah, they also get a free cruise out of the deal.
Yeah, I have thought about it, I have to say. I went with my daughter on the Queen Mary 2, and we kind of talked about it at that time that, you know, I've never done anything with it. And, of course, now it's a difficult time still for the cruise industry.
Where do you do most of your writing? Because I know you summer in PEI, and you also live in Ontario. So do you do most of your writing there?
Yeah, I wrote the whole of Revenge of the Lobster Lover here in PEI. It's when I had the idea. It's when I took a year's sabbatical and wrote the thing, beginning to end, here. What tended to happen after that, and, of course, then I was retired, so I had time in Ontario as well as time here in the summer. What tended to happen was I had a book on the go, like going through the editing process by the time I came down here for the summer. And so I'd be, you know, looking at the first draft. I'd be looking at the editor's corrections. I'd be doing all that process of producing the book. So that's how it ended up happening, writing in the winter and then down in the summer here, fixing it all up.
As you say, you are retired as a professor. That is a voluntary choice on your part. But do you miss teaching? And also, going back even further, I know you from the days when you were a news director here in Montreal on radio. Do you miss that part of your life?
Oh, absolutely. I loved radio. I loved working in radio. And that's, of course, what I was teaching as well later. So there was, you know, some of the charm was there as well.
So you have the 6 books out. You still are working on one coming up. Do you have fans who are clamoring and saying, Hillary, when is your next book coming out?
Well, I do have one fellow who gave me a wonderful wonderful review on Amazon, who was very rather annoyed that Cod Only Knows took so long to produce. It had been 3 years, I guess, between books. Yeah, so but he gave me a 5 out of 5, and he was not a 5 out of 5 guy. Rarely gave 5 stars, so yeah, some clamor.
Well, there you go. The books are Revenge of the Lobster Lover, Mind Over Muscles, All is Clam, Something Fishy, Bodies and Soul, and Cod Only Knows. And I will let you go and get back to your writing, because I don't want to keep that Amazon raider waiting any longer. Hillary, thank you very much for being on the program with us once again.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you very much.
Mystery writer Hillary McLeod. Her six books are Revenge of the Lobster Lover, Mind Over Muscles, All is Clam, Something Fishy, Bodies and Soul, and Cod Only Knows. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com to the page for this show, which is show number 0625, and you'll find links to Hillary's page and also links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order all of her books directly. And you can also find links to Hillary's previous appearance on the show, which was number 0080, way back in February of 2011. It's up on the Audia audio service under the title Hillary McLeod, Revenge of the Lobster Lover. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a show that is heard on fine radio stations like WLSL-LPFM in Dade City, Florida.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via Patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at Patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
Latitude 47 degrees 14 minutes north. Longitude 84 degrees 39 minutes west. Location Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nolman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And yes, for your reading pleasure, here he is once again, Stuart Nolman. Hello, Stu.
Hi, Peter. Wait a minute. Pilot the Bombardier. Is the target in sight? Yes, since it's in sight. Then bombs away.
Yeah, someone's been watching,
12 o'clock high, Memphis Belle.
I was actually thinking of Dr. Strangelove, but anyway.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah, you're right. I'm thinking World War II. Yeah, you're thinking Cold War.
Yeah.
But yeah, I ain't piggybacking on no atomic bomb. Thank you very much.
Okay.
But on this edition of Book Banter, Peter, we are going to talk about, aviation, the air war in World War II. And I got to tell you something. It's amazing to note how one small, somewhat insignificant event can have the power to change the course of history. And that's the case when a change in command of a U.S. Army Air Force bomber group happened on the island of Guam in the Marianas in January of 1945, when General Curtis LeMay took over from General Haywood Hansel. And these were two commanders with two different approaches when it came to the air war against Japan. However, this change in command, which on the surface looked insignificant, actually changed the tide for the remainder of the war. Not only how it was waged in the air, but how it led to the dropping of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which prompted the unconditional surrender of Japan 8 months later and subsequently ended World War II. Now, for his latest book, best-selling author and fellow Canadian Malcolm Gladwell took a page from his Revisionist History podcast and offers readers a fascinating gem of hidden history with The Bomber Mafia. Now, the book has its roots as an episode from this podcast, as Gladwell masterfully puts together a series of diverse narratives and people whose common goal was to wage a more humane, accurate air war through new innovations and practices and turns them into a logical, cohesive story. And you know what? What I liked about it is Gladwell's penchant for the lesser-known details of history that had a quiet impact on its outcome, and which is quite prevalent when you read The Bomber Mafia, especially when he details his visit to the much-ignored museum in Tokyo called, and get this, the Center of the Tokyo Raids and War Damage. Now, in fact, this book is a shining example of hidden history. It shows how a bunch of tiny fabrics that on the surface can have little or no significance at all can be painstakingly woven together, and its end result play a major part of the overall tapestry. In this case, the fabrics are the people and events that make up the once overlooked contribution of the air war, and a large-scale tapestry is World War II. It kind of reminds me of Victory Through Air Power, Major Alexander P. de Seversky's 1942 book that explained his theories of aviation and long-range bombing that could be key to an Allied victory, which was adapted as a vital animated feature-length documentary by the Walt Disney Studios a year later and played just as an important role in the Allies' long road to victory in the air war against Germany and Japan. So this book offers an important lesson on not turning your back to history's little events, for they possess just as much importance to its outcome on a much grander scale.
Plus, to generations who know nothing about geography, it also gets Guam back into the conversation.
Yeah. It certainly does. Yeah.
You know, Guam is a U.S. territory, of course, so a lot of people aren't aware of the fact that it considers itself, because of time zones, where America's day begins.
That's a great way to promote tourism in Guam.
Yes, exactly.
That sounds like a very snappy line.
Yep, where America's day begins. Anyway, yeah. This week's book is...
called The Bomber Mafia by Malcolm Gladwell. It's published by Little Brown. And it's $34.
And what other reading do you suggest within this genre, sir?
Well, sir, when it comes to the story of the air war in Japan, especially the dropping of the atomic bomb, there's a book that it came out in hardcover last year by Chris Wallace from Fox News. But he's got a good pedigree because his dad was the late Mike Wallace of 60 Minutes fame. And he wrote a book called Countdown 1945, which chronicles the 116 days that led up to the dropping of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima. And it's well put together, and it focuses on every aspect of the event, not only from the point of view of the Enola Gay, but also and Los Alamos, where they were building the bomb, but also in Hiroshima itself, what the citizens were doing, you know, leading up to the that fateful event on August 6, 1945.
Wow. Interesting topic indeed.
Oh, it is. And you know what? Chris Wallace really does a great job with this. In fact, there's going to be a second Countdown book that's coming out in the fall. It's called Countdown Bin Laden, which chronicles the 300 and so days that led up to the secret mission that hunted down and killed Osama bin Laden. So that's a new series. So good for Chris. And also, when we're talking about Malcolm Gladwell, I suggest you read the entire Gladwell library, whether it be Tipping Point, Outliers, Talking to Strangers, those books, because I read a few of them, and he also uses a lot of historical fact and historical events to use as a basis for his arguments about his different theories regarding society. So it's not just, you know, here are my theories, but here's how I developed them, and here's these parts of history that influenced it. So yeah, I recommend the entire Malcolm Gladwell library.
And this week's book is
called The Bomber Mafia by Malcolm Gladwell, and it's published by Little Brown, and it's $34.
And how can we find you without too much in-depth research?
Well, certainly not in the, in the cargo area of the Enola Gay, but in the pages of the Montreal Times every week. And either you can read the digital edition, or you can read the website at www.mtltimes.ca.
Never mind the cargo bin of the Enola Gay. I can see you in the overhead bin of a 747.
Yeah, those are the more comfortable ones. They're much more more to my size, actually.
Yes. Thank you very much, Stu.
You're welcome, Peter, and off we go into Wild Blue Yonder.
Stuart Nellman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Older.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about a racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. We do have one more item to get to, and of course, you know what that is. Yes, it's time now for The Idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff file presents the idiot of the day.
A fingerprint on a demand note led to the capture of a Missouri bank robbery suspect who had been previously sentenced to life in prison. 54-year-old Donnell Starks was charged with first-degree robbery for a July 21st heist at a Midwest bank in Chesterfield, where he handed a teller a handwritten demand note. Starks, who was on parole after being convicted in a St. Louis robbery in 1988, was carrying a Gucci bag and told the teller to hurry up or else he would shoot one of her colleagues. The teller complied and put cash into the Gucci bag before he grabbed more money from another teller and fled. He also put his hand to his waistband, indicating he had a gun. Investigators later recovered a fingerprint on the demand note that matched Sparks. Police took Sparks into custody after the fingerprint match, and he allowed cops to search his cell phone. The device indicated that he was in the area of the bank when it was held up. Now, why? Oh, why? If you're on parole for bank robbery, which means your prints are already on file, would you hand the teller a note without the benefit of gloves and also not ask for the note back after you've done the deed? Plus, during a bank robbery, why would you carry a non-burner phone that can track your movements? One reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0625. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0625. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including the podcast station, cyberstationusa.com, Verdant Square Radio, kdxradio.com, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, truetalkradio.com, downloaded on Apple or Google Podcasts, streaming on Spotify, Stitcher, and iHeartRadio, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, CKUW-FM in Winnipeg, and CFMU in Hamilton. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Void where prohibited, offer slightly different in Canada. For a complete transcript of this program, next time write down everything Peter says.